You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, podcast listeners. Thanks for tuning in to our latest look at the American League Central. I'm Anthony Castrovince, and this week, the trade deadline cometh. We'll talk with all the beat writers from around the Central to get the latest on the buyers, the sellers, and the stand patters. Of particular note, we'll see what's in store for the first-place Indians in their search for relief help now that Aroldis Chapman's off the board. And we'll see if the White Sox have slashed, pun intended, the price of Chris Sale after his jersey-cutting incident. Away we go.
You weren't with us last week on this podcast. There was a lot going down, obviously, with the Terry Ryan news. So I just didn't want to get your take on that. Obviously, that was a stunner in the industry, just given his long tenure there in Minnesota. And obviously, a guy who's greatly respected in the game. What was your takeaway from the Twins' decision to move on?
Definitely a surprise. You know, I thought that there's a chance that could happen at the end of the season. Even then, I thought there was still a chance that Terry could be back. Terry's obviously been in the organization so long. Polad's kind of known as a loyal guy, and Terry's kind of always been his guy to the point where really, Terry never really had a real contract. It was always kind of a year-to-year thing. I don't think Terry really ever saw that, kind of coming even. So I think when Polad told him, roughly about a month ago, that he wouldn't be back, I think it kind of shocked him. And then kind of talked to him right at the end of the first half, that leading into the break. And Terry just kind of told him, at this point, if you're going to make this move, there's no reason for me to be the GM the rest of the season. You might as well make it now. So they ended up dismissing Terry, last Monday. Rob Anthony, who's been his longtime assistant GM, is now the interim GM. With the Twins, last time they made a move like that was obviously a long time ago. Obviously they switched over from Terry to Bill Smith and then back to Terry, but to dismiss somebody like that in season was definitely a shock, considering that kind of that loyalty and continuity the Twins, kind of always had.
Yeah, and one question that kind of, surfaced in discussions about this thing, that I've had with people, sometimes in these situations, a long-tenured exec like a Doug Melvin in Milwaukee last year would be a great example. They're kept on in sort of an advisory role. But it seems like, in this situation, they just wanted to move on completely. Are you surprised that there wasn't some kind of, ties retained there?
Well, I think we'll see, though. I think that if Rob Anthony were to be the new GM and he were to get the job full-time, which I think is at this point still kind of a, somewhat of a long shot, if only just because I feel like the organization did this. They really wanted to, move on from Terry. I have a funny feeling they might want to just kind of, have a clean slate here and maybe go out to the organization. But if they think that, Rob does a good job here leading up the deadline, they feel like Rob's, different than Terry enough to keep him as the main GM. I think that Rob, actually I know from what I've heard that, that Terry would be welcome back in the organization if he wanted a position, kind of as an advisory role or even as, kind of a scouting role for the organization. So I think it kind of depends on who they hire. But I wouldn't fully rule out the fact that Terry could be back in the organization at some point. It just kind of depends on if they want a clean slate, and kind of go with a new, leadership, a new GM kind of outside the organization. I think if they stay within the organization and Rob Anthony is the GM, I have a feeling that Terry would be back in some sort of role.
Let's talk about Anthony a little bit. I know you had a chance to sit down with him in Boston over the weekend. And obviously he's a guy who's worked with Terry Ryan for a long time. I think in your piece even, referenced him as a disciple of Ryan, but, different backgrounds there. And Anthony seems a little more open to analytics and not necessarily as reliant on scouting. What do you think is his outlook here as far as it's kind of where the game has gone? Of course, analytics have certainly, infiltrated things a great deal. What do you think he represents, kind of a blend of the two worlds?
Yeah, I think kind of a blend is probably the best way to put it. He's an interesting guy in a sense. He started back in 87. He's actually the Twins' main PR guy for a little while, and then kind of, reset his career and went back, kind of that ground floor of going into the baseball, kind of department, went to scouting school, that kind of stuff, learned how to do all that. But really his base, isn't really in scouting like the way that, Terry Ryan's is. He's always been kind of the contract guy, the point guy, talking to other clubs a lot, so it's not like he doesn't know all the GMs out there. Doesn't know the players available and all that kind of stuff. He's always been that point guy, whenever they're talking to, agents and that kind of stuff, which is kind of a helpful thing that he doesn't have to feel like he's too lost coming in there. I think, when they made the switch over a few years ago to Bill Smith, he wasn't really as much of the contract guy or the kind of the big picture guy the way that, Rob is now. So it kind of makes a little more sense in terms of the fit. And you're right about the sabermetrics. Rob told me in the interview that he kind of values them a little more than Terry did, to the point where he's actually going to look at sabermetrics first before he kind of looks at the scouting report. So I think when he kind of looks at, you know, players they could be trading for, or even their own players they're going to trade, I think they're going to look at their own database and their own advanced stats and then kind of back that up with the scouting reports, which is kind of the opposite of what they did before. I think before, Terry was such a scouting guy that as much as Terry didn't fully dismiss, you know, that sabermetrics and certainly did have a, you know, an analytic department, I think that Terry was more likely to kind of listen to his scouts and kind of have a scouting perspective, which I think Rob understands a little bit more the value of the advanced stats that they've kind of built here over the last few years.
Well, as you've alluded, Rhett, Rob takes over at a really important juncture for the Twins in that they are, you know, clear sellers and definitely have some pieces of interest out there in the marketplace. Good opportunity to get some controllable talent into the system. Kurt Suzuki, Eduardo Nunez, Brandon Kinsler, Fernando Abad, all these guys are trade candidates. Maybe Tommy Malone, he had a rough one the other day, but had won his previous three starts, so maybe he'd be a piece for them. But how about Irvin Santana? I wanted to ask you about him, and I know Rob spoke specifically about him. What is the Twins' stance on Irvin Santana as a guy who is under their control for another couple years beyond this one?
I was a little surprised to find out Rob saying, you know, pretty specifically that he doesn't really, you know, have much interest in trading Santana unless he's kind of wowed by an offer. It sounds like the Twins feel like Santana is kind of part of their future still. The Twins still believe they're going to compete next year. That's the thing. I don't know if a new GM could come in will believe that as well. But the current regime believes the Twins can bounce back next year. Terry Ryan, when I talked to him, you know, leading into the All-Star break, you know, in that series in Texas, you know, we asked him about, you know, what he thought about for next year, and Terry was adamant they were going to compete. And from talking to, you know, Rob in that same article, he believes they're going to try to compete next year too. And he feels like someone like Irvin Santana is under contract for two more years at $13.5 million plus an option. They feel like he's a guy they could kind of still have as part of their future. Whether or not that's the right idea, we'll see. And certainly it doesn't mean that he won't be traded. It could happen. But at the same time, you know, a little surprising to hear that he's probably their best trade piece. So to hear that they're not that interested in moving him is a little bit of a surprise. But like I said, things can definitely change if a team kind of comes in there and makes a good offer, especially because there aren't that many top starting pitchers on the, you know, the market right now in terms of the, you know, trade market. It could happen. But as of right now, it sounds like Rob's kind of content to kind of listen on him, but not really, you know, not in a hurry to make a deal with him, it sounds like.
Things are not going well in the world of the Royals, and they're not going well at a time when small samples can lead to big conclusions at the trade deadline, of course. The Royals, as we record this going into Tuesday, they are two games under 500. They are 8.5 back in their division. They are 7 back in the wild card. I think you know where I'm going with this, and the question is, where are we going with this? What's going to happen here?
Well, that's the problem is that, you know, they were 48-50 2 years ago, and they made a huge run in August, September, and made the wild card game. We know what happened after that. But, you know, I think Dayton Moore in the front office are trying to be realistic. They're preparing to buy or sell at this point. It's just that they're kind of caught in limbo here. They know this team is better than this. They know it can play better than this. They're just not showing it at this time. And you mentioned it is a critical time not to be showing it. So it's really tough for them to make a decision. They've got, whatever it is, 6 more days to make a call. They've got pending three free agents, Luke Hochever, Kendrys Morales, and Edison Volquez. And they've got to make a decision on you know, whether to trade those parts off and get something and try to look forward to 2017. Or do they, you know, maybe go out and get a small piece, you know, a number 5 starter, and they're going to get Lorenzo Cain back within probably a week or so. He just went on rehab yesterday. Just kind of dig in their heels and say, hey, this is still the same team that went to 2 straight World Series. You know, we're going to fight to the finish here.
Well, obviously, you know, so much of the Royals' plan, especially last winter, was maximizing this window. And if you think about their stance last winter, was about maximizing, at the very least, the next 2 years. That'd be 16 and 17. And, you know, for that reason, obviously, if they do become sellers, it's not like they're going to trade away an Eric Hosmer, for instance. But, you know, the three guys you mentioned, the pending free agents, Volquez, Morales, and Hochever, all those guys, if I'm not mistaken, have mutual options for 2017. So I'm just wondering, and this is totally spitballing on your part, but what do you think the status is of where they'd be with those control options on the Royals' end? Is that something that you feel like would be a no-brainer to pick up for 2017, or do you think because obviously that's something that I'm sure is weighed when they're considering whether or not to sell off those pieces.
Yeah, and I've yet to see, you know, the Royals are famous for putting mutual options on the end of every single deal they pick,
yeah.
And I've yet to see anyone actually exercise those, so I would suspect that all three of those guys would opt out in you know,
right.
the free agency market. But having said that, and I was talking about this with some other guys last night, is that when you look at this pitching staff and this rotation right now, coming back in 2017, who's going to be your ace? Who's going to be the guy who's going to gobble up 200 innings? It's probably right. going to be Edison Volquez. So, I mean, he's still a relatively young man. He's been injury-free. I wouldn't be shocked if they make the decision to try to keep Volquez in some fashion, maybe do a two-year deal or something after this, because they're pitching thin right now. You look back, you look at who's going to come back in 2017. They're going to have Jason Vargas coming off of rotator cuff. They're going to probably have Mike Minor coming off of they can't keep him healthy, by the way, and he's coming off of labrum surgery. You've got Duffy. You've got Ventura and Ian Kennedy, but you still got two open spots there, and there's really no one in the system that's coming up fast enough that can fill one of those spots. Kyle Zimmer, you know, is out for the year now, and it's just they've got some decisions to make about what they do going forward with Edison Volquez. He's been he definitely has been steady Eddie. He's not having a fantastic year, but he's been pitching pretty well lately, and he's a guy, like I mentioned, can really chew up a lot of innings. And just to part with him right now at the trade deadline, I don't think is a terrific idea.
Yeah, it's kind of, you can see it from both sides, because you're right, all the points you just made are correct, and then the other point is that the pitching market being so thin, you can get a greater return for Volquez than you would in an ordinary summer swap market, but you're right, I mean, he's probably pitched better than his ERA indicates. I think there's some peripheral numbers that suggest as much, and certainly a guy who gets a lot of ground balls, so has a lot of value either way, has a lot of value to the Royals and has a lot of value in the market. What do you make of it? This is just something that's been floated, and it's probably typical silly season stuff, but, you know, Wade Davis obviously has tremendous value himself. We just saw what the Cubs got for Aroldis Chapman, and that was for 2 months of control. But Davis, you're talking about 2 years and 2 months. If you could get a number one type pitching prospect, and the name floated in connection with Davis was Lucas Giolito. I don't think that trade happens. I don't think it's something the Nationals are particularly keen on, but it does lead for fun discussion, doesn't it? If you could get something like that, a piece like that for Wade Davis, do you pull the trigger?
Well, if I'm the GM, I don't, because I think I would feel I owe it to this core group of players that you're going to make a run, maybe not only this year, but definitely in 2017. We've already noticed that without Greg Holland, that this bullpen right now is not as strong as it was last year. And if you take away Wade Davis, you're down to Kelvin Herrera and an ineffective Joaquin Soria and ineffective Luke Hochever right now. So you're almost kind of thrown in the towel for next year, too, because this team is built on pitching and defense in his bullpen, and without Wade Davis. Now, having said that, there is nobody that's untradeable. There's nobody that's untouchable. So if you got the perfect package, yeah, you probably would have to pull the trigger. But, look, a lot of teams are calling, as you know, Anthony. I mean, a lot of teams call and they talk and they ask, and, hey, what would it take to get this guy and that guy? I'm sure they fielded inquiries about every single guy on their team, from Eric Hosmer to Wade Davis. But I'd be pretty surprised. I'm not saying, I'd be shocked, but I'd be surprised if they would move away Davis, just because of the way Dayton thinks about, treating his core group of players and trying to make another run for a World Series over the next 2 years.
As far as the other side of the equation, the buy side, it sounds like from your conversations with Dayton Moore, the Royals are not in a position to add salary, correct?
That's right. I mean, it would have to be, David Glass has been very good in the last couple of years that they've had to add some pieces that he would, bump the salary up. And, it's kind of cryptic the way Dayton described it, too. He said, we didn't plan on actually adding any money at the trade deadline during the offseason, because basically they overspent in the offseason. They bumped their team payroll up to a team record, $135 million or something like that, which was really about $15 million more than I thought they had enough room to go. And so I think Dayton would have a hard time going back to Mr. Glass and saying, hey, can we add another $10 million here? But not saying that they won't make maybe a minor move or something like that just to get maybe, you know, a number five starter. The offense probably will pick up once they get Lorenzo Cain back. So I don't know if they've got, you know, enough firepower, enough resources to go get another bat. But right now, the number five spot in the rotation is really just killing them. I think if they're 8-17 or 8-18 out of that spot this year with a ERA over six, if you just got a decent starter out of your number five guy, right now they'd probably be maybe four or five games away.
What was your takeaway from your conversation with Sale?
I think I'll go up front and say, I said this in numerous interviews since the incident happened Saturday, that Chris Sale's a great kid overall. He's one of the, you know, if I had an all coverage team, which I'm sure you could think back in the years you did the Beat Anthony and pick guys, you're like, oh, these are the best guys to cover out of the group. And he would be right at the top of that. I think he has a passion for winning. He has kind of a passion for life overall. And I think sometimes the message is right, but the method may be wrong. And I think, you know, no matter how many times he did say that he didn't want to wear these jerseys, and if, you know, you go through the story, he talked to them in spring training. He mentioned again on Friday. He talked to Don Cooper, the White Sox pitching coach, Friday night when he called him about it and said he didn't want to wear them. You know, I think at some point it's kind of like, you have people to answer to. You're not running the team, so maybe you had to do it and go through it, you know. And I get it. I get the point where he said he was worried about mechanics, and that's probably the most salient point of the whole thing. He did make it clear that it had nothing to do with style or look. He said he'll wear any, you know, he was all for wearing the 83 throwbacks. The 76 throwbacks don't seem to be extremely popular among the players, although they were retailored this year to make them a more comfortable fit. They were kind of bulky and baggy last year, from what I was told. So I get his desire to win. I get his desire to give the best effort on the field. But in the process of arguing that, he kind of made it tougher for his team to give the best effort on the field. You know what I'm saying? Now, you know, the bullpen goes that whole day after Jacob Turner had a short start the day before that. So now the bullpen is taxed, which led to the Monday night game where guys like Matt Albers and Dan Jennings were used, you know, effectively usually in middle relief. Now we're pitching the ninth inning because neither David Robertson nor Nate Jones were available, and Matt Albers started Saturday. So it's not like he's had, you know, a week off and took the mound. And Chris, to his credit, apologized to the fans when he talked to me for, you know, who came to see him, and apologized to the bullpen. He said he really owes the bullpen for picking up the slack, because he's a guy who always says he hates to let someone else finish a job he started, you know, meaning he wants to go as far as he can. And now, not only did they finish the job, they started the job he was supposed to start. So it's a tough situation. In a couple instances over the years where Chris has had, I don't know, kind of, I don't want to say outbursts or meltdowns, but just disagree, strong, strenuous disagreements, he said he wishes they hadn't got to that point, but he's not going to apologize for being passionate. So people can look at what he said to me, his comments, and view them and judge them for what they are. But remember, don't forget that this is a kid who's very solid leader in that clubhouse overall. Kid who took Carson Fulmer, you know, they're one of their top pitching prospects, under his wing during the offseason, kind of made him feel at home even before he had a first appearance in spring training. The comments he made in San Diego, which I think influenced a lot of people about giving up, you know, chewing tobacco when he heard what happened to Tony Gwynn, the impact Tony Gwynn had on his life, Tony Gwynn's passing, and Tony Gwynn just as a person. So this is not a problem kid. This is a kid who is passionate, and like I said, good message. Sometimes the methods need to be a little more finely tuned, I think.
Well, yeah, and the point about the mechanics is a salient one, no doubt about it. I totally get that. And so my takeaway, beyond the fun jokes we had with all this about Sale being a cut-up or a cut above the rest or anything like that.
And he said, I should add, he said he's seen quite a few of the memes and the pictures and everything else. A lot has been sent to him. So he's aware. He's not a social media guy at all, but he's aware of the play on words and the pictures, the Chris Scissorhands that have been going around since.
Well, there's some good stuff out there. But, you know, to me, Mark, the biggest takeaway might be, where's Robin Ventura in all this? And I think Sale even kind of mentioned that in the interview. It seems like this was a moment where the manager has to, you know, take the brunt, take the heat for his players and go to management or whoever and say, look, we're not wearing these things. Let's change to the other one. And it seems like, in this particular instance, he did not have his starting pitcher's back, his ace starting pitcher's back. What do you think about that?
I guess it would be an interesting survey of fans where if you went out there, because, you know, fans do like these throwback days. There's no question that, you know, they like memories back of the old teams and what they looked like back then and that kind of thing. And it'd be interesting if you went to a fan and say, okay, tonight you get it. Because they were getting their giveaway jersey that night either way. Chris Hale could have worn, you know, shorts and a Buzz McKenzie tank top. Boy, I really went back for that reference.
My goodness.
And the Sox fans are still getting their giveaways. So would they have rather seen, you know, Matt Albers starting in Chris's place wearing, well, they didn't end up not having either one. Would they rather end up seeing the throwback jerseys or Chris Sale pitch? And I think most would side on the Chris Sale side, but it is a good point. And I think it's the one thing you can say on this is it's sad that it got to this level on both sides. You know, I think if Chris had made it clear in spring training he didn't want to wear these, which again is, you know, whatever, you take it for what it's worth. Coming out of the break, they had him start Monday and Quintana start Tuesday, and they could have easily flip-flopped them. The only thing that would have mattered is Chris wouldn't have faced the Cubs, and Jose Quintana would have. That would be the only difference, the alignment. And then Chris would have started Sunday and not pitched in that game on Saturday. Now, I think on the flip side, I'm guessing that never crossed the White Sox mind, that, oh, yeah, Chris said he didn't want to use these, so we got to switch them. I don't think, you know, promotional schedule is what you base rotations on. So, you know, there's just so many different questions to be asked. And I will tell you that, you know, there's a ton. I sat with Chris and, you know, just the interview part of our conversation was like about 33 minutes. So there was a lot of stuff that he said that didn't even get in that story because, you know, you can't write 10,000 words on what he said. But, you know, it shouldn't have gotten to this point. And I think Robin did check from what I talked to Robin, you know, one-on-one after his media session yesterday, and he did check, and basically they had to wear those jerseys that night. That had to be the situation. So, you know, it's unfortunate because I think Chris, you know, Chris wants to stay with the team. He wants to win with the team. So I think that speaks to the fact that he wants to play for Robin Ventura because Robin is the manager. And granted, this is the last year of his contract, so we don't know if he'll be the manager in 2017. But, you know, I think if he wanted no part of the situation, he would say, trade me. You know, I think you can do that when you're, you know, the ace of the staff, and if you're not happy with the situation it's going. But I think there was some bad vibes sent there that maybe could have been avoided, and it's just kind of a weird situation overall the way it manifests. I understand the core of the issue is kind of the ancillary stuff around it that ends up getting most of the attention. That's kind of bizarre.
You tell me, what is going to happen for the Cleveland Indians at the 2016 trade deadline? It is August 1st. At 4 p.m. Eastern time. What do you got?
Yeah, it'd be kind of strange to put that on the cover of the media guide next year.
Not on the cover, but it'll be the details will be in there somewhere.
Right.
I'm trying to make some kind of transition here from the media guides to the actual podcast.
You've had better.
I know.
No, they got to do something. I mean, I think if they were to walk away from this trade deadline without fortifying some aspect of their roster, it would be a huge missed opportunity for a team that is in a rare position of putting its foot on the gas pedal, so to speak, in the division. You know, it's been several years since they've been in this position where they've had this type of cushion at the top of the Central with a chance to really kind of fortify their place in the October picture. So I think they need to address the relief pitching in some capacity. I think a bat is secondary, in my opinion, but it would definitely help, especially given the uncertainty that continues to surround Michael Brantley's comeback. But I really think kind of fortifying and strengthening that bullpen is of the utmost priority as they approach the deadline here.
All right, so obviously the Chicago Cubs got Aroldis Chapman. Aroldis Chapman is not coming to Cleveland. And what the Cubs gave up to get Aroldis Chapman really raised a lot of eyebrows in the industry. We're talking about two guys who were probably instantly top five prospects for the Yankees. One of whom, Gleyber Torres, was the number one prospect for the Cubs. They also sent over Adam Warren, who's obviously a big league pitching piece. And then there's a fourth player involved. And, oh, by the way, the Cubs take on the $5 million or so owed to Chapman. That's a lot for two-plus months of Chapman for any reliever when you're talking about a limited number of innings. But obviously the Cubs are in a special place where they are, you know, very much World Series or bust. So the Indians fans are, I'm sure, frustrated to not get Chapman, but that's, to me, JB, that's one of those trades where you throw up your hands and say, you know what, more power to you if you can give up that much. I don't think the Indians are in a great position to give up that much for a rental. I don't know that many teams are. What was your takeaway of the Chapman experience?
Well, first of all, I guess you got to give the Yankees a lot of credit for, you know, this is just a classic case of flipping a player, acquiring him when the stock is as low as it is, and then flipping him and getting this type of package back is pretty incredible. Yeah, I think the Indians could have topped what the Cubs were offering, but it's totally different dynamics when you consider where the organizations are, just in terms of how they go about building their teams and planning for the future. You know, if you look at where the prospects that the Cubs gave up ranked within their system or within baseball, you know, then you're looking at the Indians having to give up at least one of Frazier and Zimmer, and then maybe the Yankees could then say, now we want Bobby Bradley, or we want one of your top pitching prospects, McKenzie or Justice Sheffield, or, you know, and I think then,
Aiken maybe,
and then, oh, and by the way, we need even more on top of that, you know, so maybe a major league ready arm, you know, a guy, you know,
Clevenger,
Cody Anderson, you know, that's a lot to give up, and these are pieces that the Indians, when they're planning, they're not only looking, as I said, to kind of take advantage of the situation this year right now, but they're also looking ahead to the future, and some of these prospects could play a key role in the near future. I mean, Zimmer and Frazier were just promoted to AAA, and you know, who knows, maybe they get a look later this year if the Indians feel that they could make an impact at the big league level. We've seen what Tyler Naquin has done this year, for example. So I think the Indians are not in a position where they can trade away a pile of prospects and then, you know, easily fill those holes that could be created down the road, where the Cubs can maybe, if they have a farm system deficiency, they can spend in free agency to sort of clog that hole temporarily. The Indians don't really have that luxury, you know, that ability to do that. So I think while the Indians could have topped that package, I just think it really would have been ill-advised to do so. And maybe it's a little different story when you're looking at a guy like Andrew Miller, where it's not a rental, you know, where it's a guy who is under control for a few more years, and even if you're not comfortable with the salary he's making in future seasons, you could potentially recoup a little bit of the loss if you flip him for prospects down the road after this year. So I think it kind of fits that mold a little better if you're going to go down the road of piecing together a larger prospect package.
Yeah, and I used to think the Indians could get Miller in a trade, and now I'm not so sure. If that's what the Yankees got for 2 months of Chapman, what are they asking for 2 years plus of Miller? It might just be one of those things where there's not an adequate deal out there. I don't know. That's a tough one. The Yankees still, as of this moment, feel like they can remain competitive even without Chapman, and that was why, you know, that was one reason why Adam Warren was in that deal. But we'll see what happens as far as the Yankees go. Elsewhere, of course, the Brewers have some relievers who are potentially attractive. They have Jonathan Lucroy, who's obviously attractive behind the plate. We've heard a lot of rumors tying the Tribe to Lucroy. What do you make of that situation? How realistic is that?
I think if they go and get a catcher, I think it's going to be Lucroy. I just don't see them saying catching is a huge need. I think they see the need for potentially adding some offense, and Lucroy fits adding offense and helping strengthen the weakest offensive position on the diamond for the Indians this season. I think last check, their weighted runs created plus was in the mid-30s, which shows you just how far below league average they've been. But there's a couple of dynamics at play here. You know, they really like what Chris Jimenez has done as Trevor Bauer's sort of personal catcher. They really think that Roberto Perez has the potential to be a starting catcher for many teams. You know, he just came back off the DL, and so while he was in a bit of an offensive slump to start off, the guy only has, you know, maybe 20-odd at-bats since the start of the season.
And he was thrown in a tough situation, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think they would have brought him off the DL when they did, had Yan Gomes not been hurt.
Right.
And then you've also got the dynamic of Yan Gomes potentially being ready to come back in, you know, a month or two. You know, so he could potentially rejoin the fold. And he signed through 2019, so there's a commitment to Yan Gomes, who's a kind of a part of the fabric of that clubhouse. You know, I think if he were to be sort of viewed as being eliminated from the starting role or maybe not being the catcher, I think it would not sit well with a lot of guys in that room. You know, so there's a commitment to Yan Gomes beyond this year. And Lucroy has a very affordable option for next year. And now you could start talking about, okay, well, Lucroy could maybe go to first next year. Napoli isn't signed through next year, things like that. So there are pieces to the puzzle that you could shift around and make it work. But Chris Antonetti's gone on record multiple times at this point saying they are comfortable with Roberto Perez and Chris Jimenez, and they're not making catching the priority. But again, adding offense is maybe a priority, and Lucroy could fit that mold, and that's why he would make sense.
Going to bring in Jason Beck. Beck, trade deadline fast approaching.
I see Al Avila bought a new shirt in Chicago the other day, but it sounds like that is the extent, or will be the extent, of the Tigers' July acquisitions. And bonus, the shirt did not get cut up by Chris Sale, so that's good. But tell me, was it a nice shirt at least?
Yeah, you know what? Somebody described it as Tommy Bahama-esque, but I think given Al's contract, it probably was Tommy Bahama.
Well, obviously, and we're joking around about the shirt, but what he said to you guys the other day is no major surprise. We talked about it for a couple of few weeks now that Tigers are very likely to stand pat at this deadline either way. They don't have much in the realm of expiring assets to trade off, and they don't have much in the realm of financial wiggle room to add on.
Yeah, it's when you're kind of at this point where the Tigers are, where you know, you're still trying to contend, but you feel like there's an impetus to get younger and get ready for the future. It's hard to have a whole lot of maneuverability. And then you add in the factor that this isn't a deep system. And compared with the other teams that are in contention right now, you know, you could probably find a half dozen Astros prospects that would qualify as the top prospect in the Tigers system. So you take that, you know, Astros, Red Sox in the same boat. You know, Cubs, certainly we've seen how they can jettison prospects and really not miss a beat because they're so deep. The Tigers aren't deep right now. I mean, it's going to take a long time before they get that sort of depth. That's the benefit of stockpiling, and that's the price you pay, I think, naturally, when you've contended for as many years as the Tigers did. So right now, you know, maybe they do a smaller deal. You know, I can certainly see them doing that. There are still teams selling mode that are scouting the Tigers farm system, looking for maybe some arms that might fit to maybe do something a little bit more mundane. But, you know, as far as making a big splash, you know, I don't see it. It would be a spectacular ruse on Al Avila's part if they were able to pull it off.
Probably the more interesting thing that came out of that talk with Avila was a discussion about Brad Ausmus. Of course, Tigers have a contract option on him for 2017, and Avila praised the job he's done this year. What was your takeaway from the stance of that relationship, Brad Ausmus and the Tigers?
You know, it wasn't anything vastly different than what Al has said previously this year, and maybe even dating back to last year when we were talking about Brad's job being on the line. But it was a little bit stronger. It was more specific, especially in terms of, you know, he really got expansive talking about Brad's bullpen management being a point of improvement from when Brad first took over. And I think when you look at this team, if this team's going to get younger, I think you really have to keep in mind what type of manager you want to be looking for the long term. And I think Brad has shown an ability to help young players develop. I think you look at where Nick Castellanos is now compared to where he was. You look at maybe not James McCann's hitting numbers this year, but how he's progressed defensively as a catcher, as a game caller in his second major league season, I think is impressive. You look at some of the young arms they've been able to get contributions from. This is stuff that didn't happen in past years. And I think, you know, while the in-game strategies get second-guessed, and I think that happens in a lot of places, I think where Brad's really shown some value here is what he's been able to get out of some of the younger players in really what's a high-pressure situation and what's not for everybody. They haven't been able to get out Stephen Moya yet. I think they're still hoping to. But by and large, they've gotten more out of younger players than they have in quite some time.
As you said, not expecting any external additions that are major splashes, but obviously some internal additions, if you will, in the form of guys coming back from injury, Jordan Zimmermann, Daniel Norris, and, of course, J.D. Martinez out in right field. What is the status of in the timetable for each one of those guys, Beck?
Well, Norris and Zimmermann are going to make rehab outings later on this week. It will be the third for Norris, second for Zimmermann. I think they're talking about sending Norris to Double-A Erie on Thursday since Toledo is off. And then Zimmerman can stay on turn to start Friday for the Mud Hens. I think they have some sort of goofy jersey promotion going on, so hopefully he's okay wearing those jerseys. You know, I hope they give him a heads up. Cause, you know, we still hear from Verlander about the dinosaur jerseys he had to wear on Jurassic Park when he made a rehab start for the Hens last year. But, yeah, at least they're getting close. I think, you know, with both those guys, it's more a matter of pitch count than anything else. Yeah, I know North kind of had a rough outing there second time around for Toledo, but I don't think they're overly concerned about that. I think they want them to stretch out the arm a little bit more. And J.D. Martinez is about to start a rehab assignment for Toledo as well. They've been talking about this for a little while, that they might start him out on rehab before he's ready to play the outfield, simply to get him a head start on getting some at-bats. So what he'll do is he'll DH for a little bit starting out, keep on doing pregame work in the outfield, throwing, trying to get the arm stretched out after the elbow fracture. And then once that's ready, then they'll move him to the outfield. They don't anticipate him needing a whole lot of games to be ready from an outfield standpoint, but they do want to have that as at least a finishing touch before they bring him back. But the big thing is, you know, you can see return on horizon. I think the timing of it coming pretty close to the trade deadline should give some people a little bit of peace of mind that they don't have to necessarily go out and get another outfielder here for the stretch run.